Session number 26581.
Group Captain Eccles, Reel 12. Anything else, generally or about operations or personalities, about your time as commanding 210 Squadron?
Yes, there was another exercise we did at what is known as JESS, the Joint Anti-Submarine School. And this was up in the RAF Ballykelly and the Navy base nearby. This was a very intense training course, not just for the RAF, but also for the Navy themselves in learning to cooperate with aircraft. In other words, for frigate escorts of convoys, say, to work in with aircraft. And we did a lot of exercises in that way. There would be a submarine in the area provided by the Navy, and there would be a frigate in the area provided by the Navy, and our job was to locate the submarine and then identify its position to the frigate and assist the frigate in homing onto the submarine. Part of this exercise was using routine, formalized methods of communicating by voice, so that it was quick, rapid, and not likely to be misunderstood, using code words.
But this was all against conventional as opposed to nuclear submarines.
Oh yes, all conventional submarines. The only change which really came in towards the end of the war was the fact that the submarines were equipped with Schnorkel devices.
Now, anything else about 210 Squadron?
No, because I was on this JAS course at Ballykelly when I was promoted and immediately posted to the directing staff at the RAF College, Staff College Bracknell.
This is a promotion to Wing Commander?
Yes.
Now, tell me what you were doing. Back to the staff coach, this time on the directing staff. You went there January 54 and you were there till September 56, so a year and a half or so, a bit more. What was it like on the directing staff? How did you see your time there?
Well, from a career point of view, being a graduate of the RAF Staff College certainly was a useful step towards future promotion. And doing a tour of duty on the directing staff rather tended to identify you as a high flyer. The work itself was obviously what I expected, because having been a student, I knew exactly what life was like. And life on the directing staff was quite interesting. I actually, after about a year or so, I managed to get onto the planning staff of the staff college, where I was responsible for devising new, up-to-date exercises for the students to follow.
Well, in what way? Tell me about what was new.
Well, one exercise I did in conjunction with an officer from the Navy Staff College at Greenwich was a coastal command type exercise involving submarines and frigates and so on. And this was an exercise of a group activity, which was not an exercise of writing, but of working together in an operations room atmosphere and dealing with problems that were handed out to the controllers, the student controllers, by the directing staff in accordance with the exercise. The clock in the operations room was normally set at about twice normal speed, so that there was not all that much time for decisions to be made, but at the same time you could progress the events occurring in the operational area of the exercise in a more realistic way.
Do you think you were learning as well as the students? I mean,
oh yes, certainly. In fact, you never cease to learn anything in the RAF. The whole of your time, you're learning. And so, yes, I certainly did. I knew a lot more about the Royal Air Force at the end of my time as a direct member of the directing staff than I knew when I started.
And what did you think of the overall quality of the students? Now you weren't one.
The standards were always very good. It was quite interesting. I remember when I first went as a student, it was pointed out to us that there were 100 students on the course, and that this figure was chosen because it was decided that one of the great requirements or aims of the course was for the students to get to know each other well, because during the rest of their careers they would meet up and have to work together, and it was a very good thing for them to, at this stage, to get to know each other. And that 100, a course in excess of 100, would not really achieve this aim. If to make personal relationships, a course of about 100 was as large as you could use. This fellowship was very much developed during the staff college, and it was obviously part of the directing staff to develop the similar kind of friendship amongst themselves, because one or two of my contemporaries in the directing staff became chiefs of their staff.
Who were they? Do you remember anyone in particular?
For example, one of them was Lord Cameron, who regrettably died in office.
And what was
no, he didn't die in office, sorry. After he retired and became Marshal of the Royal Air Force, he joined the faculty of London University, is it King's College, and he died in harness there.
Now, what was Cameron like? He had such a distinguished career. What was he like when you knew him? He was on the directing staff.
Yeah, well, he was. We were all the same. We didn't necessarily see any one member of the directing staff as being rather superior to any other member.
He didn't particularly stand out then.
Well, actually, if he stood out at all, it was because he had a dicky heart. And as a result, I have a feeling that he'd been the officer commanding the London University Air Squadron because he'd been taken off operational flying temporarily because of his health situation. Didn't seem to worry him at all afterwards, although whether his slightly premature death was a reflection of it, I don't know.
Anything else about Bracknell, the staff college, or should we move to the next posting?
Yes.
And that would be, September 56, you went to number 104 AWR, number 3 squadron.
Okay. At the end of my tour of duty at the staff college, I applied to go as a student on another career move to the RAF Flying College, which was later renamed the RAF College of Air Warfare. And this was at RAF Manby. And I was duly nominated to go on that course, or selected. So, first of all, I had to, again, because I hadn't been doing any flying for a while, and this course at Manby was essentially involved a lot of flying, I had to do a refresher course, and so I went off to do this refresher flying course at Manby, and really it wasn't so much of a refresher flying as conversion to jet aircraft, because up to this point of time all my flying had been on propeller aircraft, and now I was going on to the jet age. So I converted to jet aircraft.
And this unit was number 104, AWR standard.
I think it's all-weather refresher flying.
So it really, it's not a yeah. So let's look at the conversion to Meteor. The Meteor's a jet.
Yes, the Meteor is a twin jet.
Had you ever flown a jet before?
No, this was my introduction to flying jet aircraft.
And can you tell us a bit about, what did you think of the Meteor?
Well, it was at this stage, it was by no means a modern aircraft. It was being used as a training aircraft. Not basic training, but advanced training. I never looked upon it as anything other than simply learning to fly a jet aircraft, which was quite different in a way to flying a propeller aircraft.
In what way? I mean, people don't understand it really. I mean, what was different about flying a jet aircraft?
Well, there were a lot of differences, I suppose. One difference would be that when you're coming in to land on a propeller aircraft, when you throttle back, the propellers automatically act as an air brake and the aircraft will descend fairly positively. When you throttle back in a jet aircraft, there is no such braking effect and the aircraft tends to be more of a glider, so the angle of approach is quite different. There's also the fact that a jet engine consumes fuel at a great rate, so particularly an aircraft like a Meteor, it has a fairly limited endurance of about an hour or so. If you were flying a jet aircraft low down, you consume fuel at a great rate. And therefore, jet aircraft have to operate at high altitude. And of course, as far as I was concerned, anything above 20,000 feet to me was unknown. So I was, for the first time, flying aircraft up to 30,000 feet.
Were there any advantages in it? I mean,
well, of course, the aircraft was so much faster, and its rate of climb was so much greater. And at the end of the course, I had to have an instrument rating on the Meteor, which I obtained. And all this was just a preliminary to then starting the course, the flying college course at Manby.
I rather missed this, but I'll ask now. What you said it was a career move. Why had you decided to do this?
For career purposes, as much as anything else. The RAF Flying College was started after the war, and it was an interesting experiment. The idea was that during the war, pilots had become very experienced and competent in the operations of their particular command. Not many pilots had, during the war, gone from one command to another. The aim, therefore, of the Flying College was to give senior officers experience in operating aircraft in the environment of other commands. Now, we were at Manby equipped with Hunters and Canberra aircraft, and we would, in our ground studies, study the operational requirements of the different commands, and then with the Hunters and the Canberras, carry out simulated fighter interception exercises and bomber attacking exercises.
How realistic were the exercises?
They were very good from the point of view of giving you a taste of what the commands were up to, but in actually becoming sufficiently experienced to say that you were therefore a good fighter pilot was certainly not achieved at all, and it wasn't the object of the exercise. It was simply to give you a taste of what it was all about. In fact, I have a great memory of my first flight in a Hunter. We didn't have any dual instruction for a Hunter, so after
is the Hunter a single seater jet?
The Hunter was at that time the frontline fighter of the Royal Air Force, and we didn't have any dual instruction Hunters. So in fact, having been given a briefing on the ground, you got into the aircraft and did a circuit, and then you were okay for taking part in exercise. So having done the circuit, and my colleague Mike Hunt, who was also a Coast Command chap, did his circuit, the two of us were sent off then to fly in formation to something like 30,000 feet, where we were to carry out a practice air interception and then put our aircraft through a Mach 1, breaking the speed of sound. A Hunter could only do it in a dive. And recognizing the somewhat positive changes of trim as the aircraft went through the speed of sound. Well, of course, in Coastal Command, you don't do very much formation flying. Fortunately, I was the leader, and Mike had to formate on me, because at something like a couple of thousand feet, we're in cloud, and we didn't get out of cloud until we got to 25,000 feet. And Mike was formating with no experience on hunters, and I had no experience on hunters, and doing the best he could to keep me in sight, which he did, I must say. When we broke cloud at 25,000 feet, we did the first part of the exercise was that I flew straight and level, and Mike broke off to go away and then come and do a practice interception on me. Regrettably, we never saw each other again. I then decided, well, I'd carry out the second part of the exercise, which was doing the dive to break the sound barrier. And we were supposed to do this over the North Sea. But with the various things that have been going on, when I carried out this dive, of course, I was back in cloud again. And I was more concerned with exceeding the speed of sound and keeping the aircraft on instruments and eventually regaining height and getting down below the speed of sound, all of which went quite satisfactorily. Only when I landed, I discovered that, in fact, the aircraft had been heading over Grimsby, and I had put a boom over Grimsby.
Did you get into trouble?
No, it was one of those things. I don't think I never heard any more about it.
Was it like when you went through the sonic boom?
Well, the Hunter, the modern aircraft can go through the sound barrier without it really being noticed. But in the case of the Hunter, which was in the early days of supersonic flying, there was a very marked change of trim. And if you weren't ready to deal with this change of trim, it was possible that the aircraft might go out of control.
What was the change? In what way?
I really can't remember which it was now. I have a feeling that it first of all became very much nose down, and then it suddenly became very much nose up. And you had to trim for this nose up situation, or it might go a bit too far up.
Now, anything else about the sort of thing you were doing at the RAF Flying College?
Well, rather like the Staff College, it involved a certain number of tours to the aircraft industry and other units. It was a shorter course, it was a six-month course, and it was very much concerned with operational policy and tactics, and also sort of strategy in dealing with Cold War threat, atomic warfare and so on.
Had tactics changed much, or
I don't suppose tactics had changed all that much. The strategy was the important thing.
What was the new strategy?
Well, in the sense of if you were going to deliver an atomic bomb, you had a problem of shielding the crew from the effects of the atomic explosion. And this was no simple matter. And in the end, a tactic was developed whereby the aircraft would come at a relatively low level, go into a steep climb, let the bomb go in the climb, which would then in a way throw it forward, and the aircraft would carry on up to the top of a loop and roll over and fly straight away again, so that it was, by the time the bomb had landed, you were flying away in the opposite direction with your back to the explosion.
Anything else about Manby? Otherwise, I think then.
No.
Next thing is in July. You were there from January through to July, for it looks, and then at the end of July you went to HQ Sakland, and I don't know what that is at all.
Yes, on completion of the course, I was sent off on a NATO staff job to the headquarters of the Supreme Allied Commander Atlantic in Norfolk, Virginia. The headquarters of the Supreme Allied Commander Atlantic, SACLANT, was also two-hatted in the sense that he was the commander-in-chief of the U.S. Atlantic Fleet. And his headquarters were joint headquarters, one part being NATO and the other part being national. My particular job was to be the maritime air officer on his staff. And this was concerned a lot with developing policy and strategy and tactics for maritime patrol aircraft operating in NATO.
And what kind of area were you looking at? What recommendations did you bring forward?
Well, for example, tactics we brought forward was a policy for searching, a coordinated search in the middle of the Atlantic for a ship, whereby aircraft from different parts of Europe and America could be very quickly brought upon setting up area searches, so that these areas immediately dovetailed into each other and the aircraft all started at the same time in these different areas, so that if wherever a ship was, it couldn't escape from one area to the other without being seen. And the purpose of the exercise was simply to identify the ship. In the case of our NATO exercise, the ship we were looking for might well have been one of the Queen's in transit.
Queen Elizabeth, Queen
yes,
Mary.
Yeah.
And anything else? Any of the particular tactical problems that you remember?
No, I can tell you a nice anecdote. Admiral Gerald Wright, Gerald is spelled J-E-R-R-A-U-L-D, SACLANT, was an extremely courteous as well as a very efficient sailor. In his NATO hat, on one occasion, he called a meeting. And at the meeting, he started off by the staff of SACLANT was about 120, of whom about 100 were American Navy officers, and the other 20 were the other 30 NATO nations. He called this meeting, and he started off by saying, "Gentlemen, you may notice that I don't have any of my fellow countrymen here." He said, "That's because I want to discuss whether the border between Eastland and Westland should be east or west of Gibraltar, and I don't want yes, Admiral, for an answer." I think that illustrates quite well the kind of man he was.
Would you have much contact with him at your level? I mean, you were a staff officer, you were a wing commander.
Very much so. On a personal level, I was invited to his house. I remember on one occasion, Lord Carrington, who was then the Minister of Defence, was visiting, and my wife and I were invited to join the Minister and General Wright and his wife, just the five or six of us, for dinner. I got the impression he always had a soft spot for me, because at the end of my tour of duty, he wrote a personal letter to the Chief of Air Staff recommending that I be promoted, and he sent me a copy. There was a very big project in NATO for infrastructure projects, and as far as maritime air was concerned, this was the construction of airfields in Norway and Portugal. And I was involved in the operational requirements for these airfields.
So what sort of thing were you looking for in the sort of airfield, you know, the site that you wanted?
Oh, well, it was fairly simple. We were just sort of pointing out the kind of operations room we would need, and the ground facilities and so on.
Was this a matter of taking over existing airfields? Or
no, these were purpose-built airfields. There were two of them. One was in northern Norway at a place called Andøya, A-N-D-O-Y-A. And the other one in Portugal, I can't remember its name.
And why did we need these new NATO airfields?
Because we needed operational bases strategically placed to deal with the Cold War threat.
And these were gaps?
Yes.
And who'd identify the gaps? Was that you or was it you that...
Well, I don't know. It had all been decided before I arrived. The work was well in hand when I arrived.
And anything else that was going on?
Well, there were, of course, the various exercises that went on. I was down in Gibraltar for a few days on detachment with the US Mediterranean fleet carrying out NATO exercises. And I was aboard a carrier, the Lake Champlain, where the American Admiral was operating from for the exercise. And I was his NATO liaison officer, mainly interpreting NATO naval manoeuvring instructions, which he didn't understand. I also went an anti-submarine research and development centre in Italy, which I went to on one or two occasions.
What new developments were they working on?
Well, I suppose really it was more or less a question of producing modifications to tactics to try and deal with the latest Soviet threat.